flash flooding hit Wisconsin this week again. Rivers are running high. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Flood warnings continue this morning for points along a number of rivers, including the Fox, Baraboo, Milwaukee, Root, Sheboygan. What does flooding look like in your community? Were you spared by the latest round of rain, or are you struggling to clean up? Join in at 800-642-1234. Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisconText. That's a digital news and information service of WPR and Wisconsin Public Television. Will, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, let's look at the data you've been crunching. 2 or 3 years, we've seen a 100-year flood, a 500-year flood, 1,000-year flood in Wisconsin. What areas of the state have been hit by these intense weather events, and how you look at that data?
Sure. Pretty much every part of the state has been hit by some form of flood like this. Last year, I think a lot of people in the Dane County region and around here will remember the flood in August, which was huge. There have been similar floods in the Driftless region around Coon Valley in recent years. And then I've really been focusing on northwestern Wisconsin, kind of the Superior and Ashland area right on the Lake Superior shoreline, which has received 100, 500, and 1,000-year storms over the course of the last 3 years, as he said. And so something that we should clear up, I guess, from the beginning is that a 100-year storm doesn't necessarily mean that it's a storm that only occurs every 100 years.
Once in 100 years.
Exactly, which I think is a common misunderstanding. It's actually based on probability. So a 100-year storm is essentially a storm that, based on historical weather data, there's a 1% chance of happening in any given year. So you could have that happen multiple times in just a couple of years.
So it's a statistical thing here.
Right.
You know, it's not a firm date here. In 100 years, this will happen.
Exactly.
The National Weather Service is reporting that Green Bay broke their yearly precipitation record yesterday. So how does the heavy rain and flash flooding we're seeing this week compare to the last few years?
It's similar and different. Similar in that what we're seeing is kind of extended periods of wetness that really inundate the land and make it so that the water that then falls in subsequent rainstorms has a really hard time draining or infiltrating into the ground. It's a little bit what we're seeing this week, though, is a little bit different, though, because we haven't seen any of those like super, super really intense storms like the one up in Bayfield and Ashland counties in 2016 that dumped up to 16 inches of rain in 24 hours. We haven't seen that. And those can be really, really devastating to homes and especially infrastructure. But yeah, so they're similar, but a little different.
Prolonged periods of steady rain, though, they are still impacting the water table and just making it rise.
Totally. And that was a major complicating factor in 2016 as well. They had this huge rainstorm, and same with 2018 in the region, large rainstorm after a period of pretty wet days, just storms over and over and over again, none of which were on their own necessarily going to lead to a major disaster. But when they preceded a really huge rain event, a disaster occurred.
Talking with Will Cushman from our WisconText team. He stays with us. So we're looking at the statewide status of flooding and that compounding effect. And we want to know, are you noticing flooding more frequently in your community? What has changed over the decades in your part of Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Well, you studied storm infrastructure across the state as flooding has become more common and the issue is compounding. How are local and state governments reassessing after these severe weather events?
They're doing, in a lot of places, everything that they can, which sometimes is maybe not enough. For instance, back up in northwestern Wisconsin, after these really huge storms, so there was another one in 2012 as well that hit Superior. It was really bad across the lake in northeastern Minnesota, but that one also hit Superior. So since 2012, there have been three really major storms in this region. And there are communities in the region that have had roads wash out out every single time in the same place. And those road washouts are occurring because the infrastructure that helps water flow across the landscape and across roads, namely bridges and culverts, culverts being those pipes that run underneath the road that direct water under it, those have they've discovered have been undersized. So essentially the culverts just aren't wide enough to handle the huge volumes of water that are flowing, trying to flow through them after these huge storms. And so communities are trying to upsize these culverts, but culverts are really, really expensive, both in terms of the actual material costs, but then placing them can be really expensive too. A lot of earth movement is involved sometimes. So these are really expensive investments. And so local communities often don't have the resources to...
At the municipal level.
Exactly. So townships and villages, counties even, don't have the resources to pay for these huge upgrades to culverts. So they depend a lot on state and particularly FEMA, the Federal Emergency Response Agency, which does have grants for rebuilding after these major disasters. The problem is that FEMA often... It usually requires that the infrastructure be replaced in kind, meaning that the culverts have to be built as they were prior to the disaster. So when the culvert was undersized to begin with, it's going back in. Of course, it's not surprising to anyone, especially these officials, that they are washing out again and having to be replaced.
All right. You're replacing it with engineering that is the same as it was in the past. So you're going to get the similar outcomes in the future if you have these rain events.
Yep.
So looking at the wetlands, can we point to some causes here? Are there many factors contributing to the loss of wetlands in northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, and a lot of it goes back to all the way to the beginning of European settlement. So in the late 1800s, when the region was essentially clear-cut and cleared for agriculture. So there are a couple things that went on there. First, the vast forests in northern Wisconsin acted as a basically regional wide sponge, could absorb a lot of rainwater in a way that the current landscape is not able to. And also a lot of wetlands were filled in mostly for agricultural production. And that's been reversing a little bit in some regions as fields are taken out of egg production in areas in northern Wisconsin. But there's still I think statewide, the figure is that the state has lost half of its wetlands since European settlement, and that varies state by state. But up in the region in northwestern Wisconsin, it's a pretty similar number to that.
And these wetlands are really pivotal when it comes to these huge rainfall amounts, I would imagine, because they can absorb some of this excess?
Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of something that I've learned in my reporting that I think is really interesting and kind of surprising to me is that wetlands are not always what you kind of think of as a typical classic wetland, you know, like bulrushes or cattails in a shallow pond or lily pads, stuff like that. A lot of wetlands actually don't really look like what most people imagine wetlands to look like. It can be kind of like uplands in a forest that for maybe most of the year is pretty dry, but the land is able to absorb a lot of water, mostly in the springtime or when there's like a huge rain event.
We're taking a historical look at the impact of floodwaters in our state with Will Cushman. He's an associate editor at WisConText. How do you try to keep heavy rain from ruining your home or your fields? Maybe flooding affects your business. What steps are you taking? What are local leaders doing to help? What does the engineering look like? Be part of the conversation at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Flooding problems are widespread across southern Wisconsin. Cleanup efforts, they're underway. We're talking about flooding here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Damage reports are coming in from counties including Ozaukee, Waukesha, Dane, Jefferson, Grant, Dodge. A record 2.4 inches of precipitation recorded at the Dane County Regional Airport yesterday. Even some areas along Lake Michigan could experience erosion and lakeshore flooding. So how do you try to keep heavy rain from ruining your home or your fields? What are you going through right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Will Cushman from our WisconTex team, he stays with us to talk about how flooding is affecting our state differently than in decades past. And that's true across Wisconsin, not just in areas hit this week. Let's go to the phones now. Gary is joining us from Iron River. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, folks. Say, I think we've got to concentrate a lot more on what we could do to slow down the speed of runoff. As time has gone by, more people have bigger houses, bigger roofs, paved driveways, paved roads. Farmers' fields are land level, so the water runs off quick. And compared to 50 years ago, even with development that occurred with the forest being cut, the runoff continues to be faster and faster and faster as we have more and more people and more and more surfaces that allow it to run quickly to the rivers and streams.
Gary, thanks so much for the call. Will, what is the impact of runoff?
Gary makes a really great point. A lot of the problems that have been caused in these major storms have been because of, as he said, the high velocity of the water that's running through these rivers. It's just really gushing through these rivers in a way that it hadn't historically before really before development and before the loss of so many wetlands. So you hear a mantra from a lot of people who are proponents of wetlands and other ways of slowing down the runoff, slow the flow. That's like this mantra that comes across a lot. Slow the flow of the water as it's after it falls on the land, make sure that it stays where it falls as long as it can infiltrate into the ground and not just run off immediately into these rivers, which then it just really speeds down these rivers, and that can cause erosion in the riverbeds. And then a kind of complicating factor of that I've learned is that it causes erosion, and the riverbeds will then kind of deepen and deepen and deepen over time. And then the riverbeds even get disconnected from the wetlands within their floodplains. And so not only do they not have the benefit of the wetlands kind of at the upper parts of the watershed, they don't have the benefit of the wetlands in the floodplains because they're so far below the floodplains. Also, the wetlands in the floodplains become degraded because they're so disconnected from the rivers. And it's just kind of this
domino
feedback. Yeah, it's not great.
Let's go to Paula now in Rock Springs. Hi, Paula.
Hi. So my question goes off of Gary's. Also, with everything that flows into the river, with us living near the Baraboo River having flooded over and over again, is there any engineering looking at, like, dredging these rivers where all the excess mud has gone into them? Is that creating more flood problems?
Paula, great question, because we do dredge the Mississippi.
We do, yeah, and that increases the flow. So it's kind of the opposite of slow the flow. And, Paula, I think there are places where that happens, as you said, the Mississippi. And I know here in Dane County, the local officials are spending a lot of money on removing weeds from the Yahara River to try to increase the flow of the Yahara draining the lakes here in Madison, because that's been one of the problems in Madison, not in addition to the kind of like short-term flash flooding from these huge rain events, is the fact that these rivers, like the Yahara, are not able to efficiently carry away the water, and then the lakes stay at a high level. And I think people in Madison will remember last summer on the east side, there was high water blocking off roads for weeks, even months. There's different solutions for sure.
Talking with Will Cushman from WisconTex, we're talking about flooding, why it happens, what floodwaters do to infrastructure, how we're planning to avoid it in the future. Are you dealing with this latest round of torrential rains in southern Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. Well, going back to Lake Superior for a moment, in 2016, the tributaries flowing to Lake Superior reached their highest levels. The excess amounts of rain are connected to our changing climate. What have you heard from researchers about the area's future in that sense?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most fascinating parts of the reporting. One of the most fascinating things that I've learned is, and also a little scary, is that the I talked about culverts before and how they've essentially been undersized in the region for a long time and aren't able to handle the flow of water going through them. So part of that is because engineers have generally been using, up until pretty recently, standards for 100-year storms that are based on a guidance from NOAA and the National Weather Service from like the 1970s. And that depends on data from decades earlier. And so that was updated by NOAA in 2012, that guidance for a 100-year storm. And they found that in the area around Ashland, so Ashland, Bayfield County, Iron County, and also Douglas County, they found that what engineers have been using to size culverts and bridges, that guidance for a 100-year storm was really inadequate. And it's actually, a 100-year storm is about 30% larger than they thought it was. And they're expecting that to basically only continue. The magnitude of these low probability storms is expected to get larger.
Does that have anything to do with like outdated maps? Is the mapping not updated? What's going on?
I think it's mostly dependent on actual like historical weather data. Okay. So it seems like it was just the climate period that they had been using prior is just, it's already so different than it was in the mid 20th century, especially in that region for some reason. That was kind of like the epicenter in the upper Midwest, they found, of kind of lowballing these 100-year storm estimates.
Going back to Bayfield County and looking how that county is trying to secure the funding to not just repair but upgrade their roads, their storm infrastructure, is there any movement on the state or federal level to change policy to get those dollars there?
I know Bayfield County is applying for a grant from the federal government to upgrade one of its county roads, so it can be kind of like an all-season connector. One of the big problems in Bayfield County that they've had after these big storms is that there's really only a couple main connecting roads, north and south, really just one in one part of the county. And when it's washed out, that can lead to huge detours. And for a county like Bayfield, which is really heavily dependent, its economy on tourism, and then other industries that heavily rely on transportation, that can cause a lot of problems. There is also movement at the legislative level and at the federal government. There has been a bill proposed or submitted in the Senate. It's passed committee, but I don't think it's gone to the full Senate. Senator Tammy Baldwin is one of the co-sponsors. And the point of that bill is it would direct the Federal Highway Administration to consider resiliency in its grants for post-disaster infrastructure upgrades, which could have a big impact. Because as I said, now FEMA and also the Federal Highway Administration, they generally only will fund repairs to infrastructure as it was before the disaster.
Right, so keeping an eye on that legislation. Dane County, we had talked about the extreme flooding last year, and the county executive announced his budget proposal this week. It included a number of flood mitigation and response strategies. What is Dane County doing?
One of the big things that Dane County is doing is that cutting the weeds in the Yahara, trying to get the water flow through the Yahara, get it flowing faster to drain the lakes faster. I think Dane County is also looking at upgrading some of its transportation infrastructure, including culverts, upsizing some culverts. That's also been a problem in southern Wisconsin for sure. I haven't been following the movements in Dane County as closely, but mm-hmm. that's what I know about that.
And another $3 million flood risk mitigation fund. So definitely putting dollars there to try to deal with this.
For sure. And I think Dane County is in a position that some of these smaller counties might not be in terms of resources.
As we wrap up here, how are southern Wisconsin communities dealing with the costs of flood recovery and upgrades? Like, where do they go? Is it very individualized?
It is really individualized. A lot of these decisions are made at the township level, which can be a problem when some town leadership is really proactive, but maybe the next township over, the leadership is not as proactive or not seeking similar solutions. So there's kind of like a patchwork of work going on. But I think most of the communities are really looking at ways that they can cost effectively upgrade infrastructure or build or maintain wetlands so that they function better. There are a lot of options, and communities are kind of seeking them all.
Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisContext, and that's a digital news and information service of WPR and WPT, featuring news reporting, research, community-based expertise. We have a link, by the way, to articles on WisContext.org. Visit our show page, WPR.org/mornings. Still ahead, we explore how understanding social media better could help predict or maybe even prevent youth who get wrapped up in gang violence. That conversation coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about researchers who analyze social media posts about grief and stress to prevent violent crime among young people. And there's research that finds a pattern on social media posts. That is, young people post expressions of trauma and grief or stress before turning to more aggressive or threatening posts. So do you believe law enforcement should monitor social media to help prevent violence? Could it help stop violence? Have you ever been threatened on social media? What did that look like? We're at 800-642-1234. Desmond Patton is an associate professor of social work and sociology at Columbia University. He's founding director of a research initiative. It's called Safe Lab. It looks at ways in which youth of color navigate violence on and offline. Desmond, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with this online tool that you developed to detect aggression and grief in social media posts. How does it work?
So for the past 6 years, my colleagues and I have been working to develop a set of algorithmic systems that look at expressions of grief and loss, aggression, and substance use. What's different about our approach is that we are very clear on the fact that we don't understand the hyperlocal language, nuance, and culture in social media posts, and that when you don't, when you misinterpret social media posts, you run the risk of criminalizing those individuals. And so what we do is that we hire young people from communities from which the data comes from, and we work with them to make sure that we understand the language, we understand the conversations, and we also consult with them around the ethics of developing these tools. And all of that input, those qualitative insights, go into developing this algorithmic tool that we have not yet deployed either, in part because we are concerned about the ways in which these tools may be used in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, so this is like a monitoring tool, you know, made up on the back end by some algorithms. How can it understand the nuance that you would find in social media posts in a particular neighborhood?
So I would say that it's not a monitoring tool. What we're trying to do is to elucidate new patterns in social media data that have previously not been understood. So, for example, what social media and artificial intelligence allows us to do is to look at large amounts of social media data and to understand black box items that we previously may have misunderstood. For example, what we have found is that in our Chicago data set, expressions of grief and loss would come before more aggressive posts within about 2 days. And that was previously not discussed. We had typically thought that young people were using social media to kind of bolster arguments and to taunt one another, but actually they were leveraging it for help-seeking behaviors. And we understood that by being in conversation with young people, by privileging their voices, by understanding their needs, and by leveraging that those deep insights to make sure that when we are using a machine learning tool to understand the language, that those insights are embedded in the way in which the tool works.
Social media hasn't been around that long. Take us back to your early days of looking at this. Why did you decide to examine this relationship between what you're seeing on social media and violence?
you know, this all started from young people. I am a qualitative violence researcher and did my PhD in Chicago at the University of Chicago, and I was following a group of high-achieving African-American young boys. And they alerted me to things that were happening on Twitter. This is back in 2012, and they kind of identified a set of cases where young people were going back and forth, and that back and forth then led to violence offline. And so I went to the literature to learn more about it, and essentially there was nothing really there. And so in 2013, my colleagues and I from the University of Chicago sought out to really put some parameters and theory around this new phenomenon that at the time we called internet banging or cyber banging.
Yeah, what is that? Help us understand what internet cyber banging is, internet banging.
You know, it's a term that I'm in tension with right now, but it was a play on words, essentially trying to understand patterns of conversation and behavior in social media space that mimic the real world in terms of gang-like behavior. However, what I'm struggling now with the term is that it's too individually focused, and that these behaviors that we see on social media don't happen in the vacuum, and there isn't enough light shining on the social and systemic and structural issues that shape why people engage in these conversations in the first place. And there isn't enough consideration around the way in which these platforms are developed that may also enable these behaviors as well.
Help us connect some dots here. How could gangs, how a person wrapped up in a gang, how might they be using their social media?
So here's the thing. I think it's not really helpful to focus on individuals that may be associated with gangs. We see these behaviors consistently throughout a diverse population. I think what's different is context, right? And so it is not uncommon from all walks of life for us to see aggressive and threatening communication on social media. I think that we can all identify some a few really key examples in our life. I think what's different in the communities that I work in is that when those conversations are had, there is a ecology of violence that also informs how people need to respond offline. And in part, that response can take different pathways because of one's susceptibility to violence offline. And so, again, I think understanding the context around the conversations, around the language, is probably the most important piece here.
Yeah. So what happens when there is a conversation on social media? How does that then translate to the brick and mortar of the real world with relationships and people face to face?
You know, what's really challenging is the visibility and virality of social media. And so conversations that were typically had, 20 years ago probably could have been de-escalated or resolved because it would take longer for the content to disseminate through a network. Now, what you say, what you do has direct impact. It moves really quickly, can be screenshot and saved and sent through the masses in your network and in networks that you're not a part of as well. So this is a part of the kind of process or the pathway by which what you say can lead to trouble offline.
We're talking with Desmond Patton. He's an associate professor of social work at Columbia University in New York, and he's founding director of Safe Lab. It's a research initiative at Columbia focused on examining the ways in which youth of color navigate violence on and offline. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are some posts that you have seen on social media that you think are threatening, or have you been threatened on social media? What are those posts like? Are there specific languages that go on in your neighborhood with your friends? Join in at 800-642-1234. Desmond, how do we accurately understand the language, the context, the culture, when there are so few words on social media that those words may hold a lot of weight and have a lot more meaning than we may think they do?
Well, first, I think it's important to take a step back and to ask ourselves, why do we want to understand the context and how are we using that context? And so if we're using the context to support people, to get them resources and to create an environment where they can thrive, then I think it's important that we understand the language that's being used. For example, oftentimes rap lyrics are misinterpreted or misconstrued as being aggression. Even in our own algorithmic systems, what we found is that oftentimes the use of the N-word would be identified as being aggressive as opposed to understanding the deeper meaning. And what happens is that when those types of posts are misinterpreted, they can be used as evidence in the legal system. And it's missing key environmental and cultural understanding that may paint a different picture. And so again, I just want to reiterate this point that we need to really first think about the questions that we're asking of social media data, that we're asking of artificial intelligence before deploying it in any kind of social environment.
What are some examples, perhaps, of emojis and symbols that you now interpret to be an actual threat? What is the impact of emojis?
So I think that emojis are important, but once again, I think that there isn't one emoji that makes the difference. We have to have a contextual understanding here. So, for example, in my lab, we have understood that the devil face emoji in some instances may be an indicator of aggression. But when we look at that and generalize it to a larger population, it had a very different connotation, very different meaning. So I think that we have to make sure that we are looking at emoji and languages within the intended audience context before deciphering or making any kind of broader generalizable meaning around them.
Let's bring in Eric and Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I had more of a comment. I just wanted to say this social media tool to algorithmically track patterns of violence and grief and loss is different. But personally, I think that this is going to be utilized by the government as a monitoring tool. Creator said it's not intended to be, but I don't see how this technology couldn't be used like that. And I personally don't want to live in a type of world like that.
Eric, thanks so much for the call. And we're going to get to an answer from Desmond Patton in just a moment. He's an associate professor of social work at Columbia University, founding director of Safe Lab. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What are the posts that you see on social media in your own neighborhood, in your own community? How do you communicate? Are you a member of law enforcement? Do you deal with people on social media? Does your department use social media to track behavior or other violence? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about social media posts and what they tell us about violence. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. A lab at Columbia is finding that young people post expressions of trauma and grief or stress before ratcheting up, before turning to more aggressive or threatening posts. So do you think law enforcement should look at social media to help prevent violence? Have you ever been threatened on social media? We're at 800-642-1234. Desmond Patton is an associate professor of social work and sociology at Columbia, and he founded the Safe Lab there. Desmond, going back to Eric and Madison, who called in and says this could be a real slippery slope with law enforcement. How might police use social media data?
Well, here's the thing. I actually really agree with Eric. I think his point is well taken. And I think the challenge is that it can be misused. What the reality is that we already live in a surveillance state. So our social media, our communication, our conversations are already monitored. We have seen this in New York City. We've seen it in Chicago. And so I think that it's something that should already be on our radar. I think within our lab, what we have changed our direction, what we've understood by privileging the voices of young Black and brown young people is that they're actually using this space to get support and to get help, and that we can be a part of helping them get those resources before things become more challenging. But with regard to law enforcement, I think that we really need to think critically about the use of these tools for as evidence in the legal system. I think what we've learned is that understanding the context is extremely hard. So when we first started out, we started to use the gold standard artificial intelligence systems, and none of them worked on identifying and understanding the language from the communities that we were working in. It failed every single time. However, when we began to include young people in our process, when they became the central focus point, the systems were better at identifying loss and trauma and aggression, but we still have errors. There is still bias that we need to consider. And what I'm concerned is with the false positives and the false negatives. When we get things wrong, what happens? And when we think we get things right, what happens? And so I think that we really need to stop and think about the extent to which these approaches, the use of social media, the use of artificial intelligence, can lead to a new e-carceral state.
Implicit biases through these tools, through artificial intelligence, having biases embedded in them?
So oftentimes we focus on the tools, and I really think we need to focus on the people. We are developing the tools. We are putting in our biases into the creation of these tools. So first we need to think about a racial literacy that's important to developing these tools. So Matale Nkande at Harvard Berkman Klein Center has been working to develop a set of racial literacy tools for really helping us to think about the questions that we should ask of AI before deploying it in any social system.
Let's bring in Dick now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Dick.
Good morning. And I have to say, you know, first, I'm a judge. And one of the things I sometimes deal with young people who are in difficulty, and one of the things that strikes me is that sometimes we look at this in respect to the last caller as only a criminal justice matter, and it's not necessarily that. We have to look sometimes at early interventions through the mental health and other systems as well. And in that context, how can we use, as people in the community, parents, adults, people in responsible positions, use this type of information to look at something and say, look, you know, here's a kid who may need some help, and, you know, let's get to him before he becomes a statistic. And I think, you know, that's a huge problem. But how do we keep somebody from, we're trying to prevent people from entering the criminal justice system when we're dealing with juveniles.
Dick, thank you so much for those observations. Desmond?
I completely agree, and that's a really important point. And I think that one of the things we need to do is just raise some awareness around what people are saying and doing on social media, and to understand that the language may say more than what we think. And so oftentimes in the data that we're looking at, young people are crying out, I need help, I'm struggling, I feel pain, I feel trauma, and it just sits on the platform, and it sits, and it sits, and it goes nowhere until someone else sees it and either retweets it, reshares it, screenshots it, and then it takes a different pathway in a different direction. I think there's an opportunity to harness some of these call-outs to adults, to support networks, and to be able to connect young people with resources. And so we could then, you know, take a post and then wire that post to a set of social workers or to a school counselor or to a church or to a hospital so that people can get the type of support that they need when they are leveraging these tools to do so. But again, I think we've had a missed opportunity because we have only focused on a very punitive lens and on a criminal justice perspective. And what I'm trying to kind of articulate to a lot of folks from a social work perspective is that there's so much that can be done before those posts actually are problematic in the first place.
Yeah. Do you think we're behind from a social work perspective because we have the 800 numbers, we have various places in our communities where you can walk in the door or to receive help, but are we lagging on the social media front?
Well, here's the thing. A lot of people do not have access to these resources in their community. They can't just walk in the door. They don't have the means or the support to do so. But social media is a purely unadulterated space where we can present possible selves and multiple selves and to be vulnerable, hyper-vulnerable in these spaces. And so I think that we really need to think about social media as a new ecological environment where behavior happens, and we need social workers and mental health practitioners that are in this new ecological environment to help support people as well.
You have this history of hiring researchers, troubled young people from Chicago. How have they perhaps redefined where you go with your research? Have you seen your own work in a different light?
100%. We have taken a completely different direction. I think that one of the things that we did wrong in the beginning is that we were imbibing these stories about young Black and brown young people and assuming that the way in which they would use social media would be negative. Then when we dug deeper, we started to read these stories, understand these narratives, and hire young people, we realized that we were looking at the wrong thing and that we weren't humanizing these folks. And I think that that was a course direction that was forced by listening to young people, hearing them, trusting them, and believing them. And now we are focused on understanding their life from their experiences, from their mouths. And so now the direction that we go is led by what the young people tell us and not what we think we should be doing in this space.
When you have conversations with young people and you've seen troubling posts, as a social worker, where do you start those conversations? What do they look like? Because many of these youth are living on social media. So much of their life is online.
You know, it's about meeting people where they are. And it becomes a really interesting kind of dynamic when a young person knows that you understand their social media space. And so we have been spending time with young people in Brooklyn, and it just opened up a new way of engagement in which they can then bring in stories that are happening at school, in the family, and in the community vis-a-vis their communication on social media in a way that may not happen when they're talking to a teacher one-on-one or talking to a social worker. It becomes a talking point that they're excited about, they're engaged with, and that they want to explore more. And so I think bringing in social media into conversations with young people and allowing them to share what's happening, what's being posted, what's being shared is a great entry point to having hopefully more open conversations that can prevent future more problematic conversations down the line. And what I really hope is that we really begin to help young people think about a more informed way of being online, not a good or bad binary, but what does it mean to be a digital citizen? What does it mean to be a part of this new environment, this new world that you live on? And how do we help young people make the most informed decision about how they show up in digital spaces?
Desmond, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Desmond Patton is an associate professor of social work at Columbia University in New York, and he's founding director of Safe Lab. It's a research initiative at Columbia focused on looking at the ways in which youth of color navigate on and offline. Just ahead, we take a closer look at why thousands of donated kidneys are thrown away each year in the U.S. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.